Say thank you sufficiently to everybody for putting this event together. I just don't know how to say thanks to everybody for putting this event together. This idea came up several years ago when the folks at KTC said, you know, you go to other Dharma centers and give weekend teachings. How about you do one here? And I'm like, sure. And so this year they picked a topic that I had not addressed in some time, and that was the 12 links of interdependent origination. But because that title is somewhat daunting, I thought it might be better to talk about it as the path to freedom, because it's almost as though the teaching is about how we go from being confused samsaric beings to awakened beings, and so that's why I gave it this particular title, the path to liberation or the path to freedom, because you could say that this the illustration that we've been discussing, and that I just realized I didn't make extra copies of. This illustration we've been discussing is, I've got like seven copies of it here, is one of the very first Buddhist teachings ever committed to paper or canvas or, you know, however you'd like to call it. It's one of those, because it actually was painted for the first time at the time of the Buddha. The story goes that King Bimbisara, one of the patrons of the Buddha, had received a precious gift from another king from a neighboring kingdom. And he said to the Buddha, well, what should I give in return? And the Buddha said, paint this and then give it to this king, and it will be a great gift in return. So at any rate, that's a little bit about the history of it, how it came to be. And we started discussing it yesterday, and we're going to continue discussing it today. The way I present this is a little unusual. I go through the drawing three separate times, and add a layer of detail each time I go through it, because it's so much easier to do it one layer at a time rather than trying to do an entire teaching deeply all at once, because if you miss something, then then it's a little difficult to grasp the next section. So that's kind of how I've decided to do it. It looks to me like I probably is there anybody who was not here yesterday? Okay, so I'll give just a brief recap, and then we'll go back to the drawing for the next part. Yeah, I have I have like four or five more drawings. So yeah. Okay. Justin, you're a teacher. Hold that for a minute. Okay. You're a teacher. You understand?
Yeah.
Yeah, just hold on. Yeah, you just have a seat. Yeah. there's a joke. This is a teacher joke. I had a professional presenter once tell me, don't give the handouts while you are talking about something else, because they will not listen to what you're saying, because they will be so absorbed with the beauty of the thing you have just handed out and be so fascinated with it that just about 5-10 minutes, and then after 5-10 minutes, they will do it. I'm sorry. oh, never mind. Before we even do that, let's start with a prayer. I remembered today. Okay, my cell phone. If I don't silent it, you know. Okay. Let's start with a Buddhist prayer. I'll start with the four-line refuge prayer in Tibetan. I'll only recite it once. And if you are familiar with the prayer, you can join in. But if it's a prayer with which you're unfamiliar, you can join in your heart and in your mind, thinking that you dedicate this session of practice to all sentient beings. O Sanje Chodan Soji Chonam La Jang chu pardu dani kyap su chi. Da ji jin so ji be su nam ki. Dro la pen shir san je tru par sho. San che chu dan sa chi cho nam la. Jan chu pardu dani kyap su chi. Da ji jin so ji be su nam ki. Dro la pen shir san je tru par sho. Sanje chudan so chi cho nam la. Chang chu pardu tan ni kyap su chi. Da ji chin so ji be su nam ki. Dro la pen shir san je tru par sho. O palin sawe lama rinpoche, dagi chi war pede ten shila, kadrin jembo kone che son te. Kusum tugi ngudrup saldu son.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I lost mindfulness for just 1 second and I kept going.
It just kicks in, you know.
It's the habit kicks in, I tell you, which is actually kind of good. It's not just that habit kicks in is not necessarily always a bad thing. Sometimes it's a good thing if the habit that you've developed is a habit of dharma, you know. So and just saying, you know. Anyway, okay. All right. Hi. Good morning. Okay. See if I can do all this without making a mess. How am I doing, AV team? Am I too, is this too high, too low? We're good? Okay, all right. Yesterday, we introduced the topic of the path to liberation by talking about the basic teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha said that all of us possess something that we now call Buddha nature. We have a mind that has the potential to know itself and to know itself completely. And this complete knowing of one's own mind is called Buddhahood or awakening. We awaken to the nature of everything. The Buddha talked about this world in terms of the two truths, the relative truth and the ultimate truth. The relative truth is the truth of how things appear. The ultimate truth is the truth of how things really are. And yesterday we gave a scientific example. The relative truth is that this table appears to be solid, real, of a piece, unchanging, and so forth. It has that appearance. That's how the truth of how it appears. But the truth of how it really is that it's made of atoms and molecules, and inside those atoms and molecules, there's whizzing electrons and lots of space. So you could say, from the ultimate point of view, that this table doesn't exist the way we think it does. It exists in a way, but not in the way we think it does. And so this is the an example of relative truth and ultimate truth. The same can be said for the phenomena that arise in our mind. When we have a thought or an experience, we might think of that thought or experience as being somehow solid and real. And yet, that's the relative appearance of it. It appears solid, appears real, and so forth. Permanent. And yet, if we suddenly change the subject in our mind, such as if we're having a conversation and the phone rings suddenly, and we change our attention away from that dazzling thought we were looking at that we thought was so real. And we changed our attention to the telephone call. Hello, how are you? That thought that we just left behind, it disappears. And this natural disappearance shows the ultimate truth of thought and the ultimate truth of mind, which is that it's not solid, not real, not permanent, not unchanging. And so the Buddha spoke about the world in this way. The world is a world of relative truth and how things appear, and ultimate truth, how things really are. The problem we experience, he said, was that we take the relative to be ultimate. In other words, we take things as they appear, and we believe in things as that they are as they appear. And in fact, one Buddhist, a modern Buddhist teacher said, one of the reasons we suffer so much in this world is that we try to paint permanence on a very shifting, impermanent world. And we want to grasp after things and hope that they will last forever. Or perhaps we fear that they will last forever. And so this causes this grasping at things as being as they appear is the cause for great suffering. And this is borne out by the Buddha's Four Noble Truths, the Buddha's teaching on the Four Noble Truths. Suffering is part of life. That's the first noble truth. We all know that. But yet it's really hard to internalize, because when we experience suffering, we run and try so hard to escape that suffering. We feel it's undeserved and unfair, and we try to escape. The big three: drugs, sex, rock and roll. I mean, you know, the idea is that but there are so many more methods of escape that we use trying to escape the truth of our suffering. The second of the noble truths is that this suffering has a cause. The Buddha said the cause of suffering is clinging and fixation. Now, frequently in older texts, they'll use the word desire, that desire is the cause of suffering. Being a word person, that journalism degree does come in handy sometimes. Being a word person, I like fixation and clinging better, because they imply a certain willfulness that you don't get from desire, the word desire. So we willfully cling to this idea of something, or this person, this thing, this whatever, we cling to it. And because we cling to it, we suffer. As one Buddhist teacher said, if something hurts so much, it's because I'm holding on so tight. And as another Buddhist teacher once said, we human beings have a great talent. We're very talented. We can destroy our ability to enjoy anything by clinging to it. A lot of people joke around about Buddhism. They say, oh, you Buddhists, you're a bunch of killjoys. You're talking about suffering all the time. But that one quotation meant a lot to me. We destroy our ability to enjoy anything. And that means life, too. We destroy our ability to enjoy life by clinging to things so tightly. So anyway, that's just me going back on that comment. But since we know the cause of suffering is clinging and fixation, the third noble truth, the solution to suffering, is easy. It's letting go. If clinging is the problem, letting go is the answer. And then the fourth noble truth, the path that leads to the elimination of suffering, it becomes very clear. It's the how of letting go. I mean, as I said the other night, you can't just look at a person who's suffering and say, oh, I'm sorry you're suffering, just let it go. It's irrational. You can't do that. You have to provide the how. And so this brings us to the four statements that the Buddha made. Do no harm, practice virtue, and tame your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha, meaning there is no other. That last one's just a summary, so we just have three. Do no harm means not to harm yourself, not to harm others. Practice virtue means to take care of yourself and benefit others. And tame your mind means to meditate and come to understand the two truths, the truth of how things appear and the truth of how things really are. So that's a capsule description of what we spoke about yesterday. I apologize, there's one little bit I left out. In the discussion of the Four Noble Truths, when we talk about the cause of suffering, the Buddha said that of all of the things we cling to, people, places, things, ideas, the thing we cling to the most is our concept of self. We think, I am a real person, I am this, I am that, this world revolves around me, and so forth. And this self-clinging is the root of all of our suffering. And we spoke about this yesterday in the context of the drawing, in that we spoke about these two seemingly incompatible teachings of the Buddha. They seem to be incompatible. Everyone has Buddha nature, and everyone's confused. It would seem that these two teachings are somewhat incompatible. They create a bit of paradox in the mind. But what's interesting about it is, if you hear the Buddha's teaching about the mind, it makes sense. The teaching about the mind is that the mind of an individual, which is separate from every other mind, we are not part of one big mind. We are not part of one big mind. We all have individual and discrete minds that the Buddha said have existed since the no beginning of time and will exist until the no ending of time. So we got time. We got time. So we have this mind that is without color, shape, location, beginning, or end. This vast, limitless mind. And yet, we misperceive it. We misperceive it. Mind is said to have two characteristics. Emptiness, which I prefer to call limitlessness, because I like, emptiness says the number zero to me, and that's not what it is. It's just empty of limitation. No color, no shape, no location, no beginning, no end. So it's limitless, and yet it's not inert. It's not just empty space. Inside this mind, we experience things. We experience thoughts, feelings, ideas, perceptions. We have all kinds of experiences that happen in the mind. So while the mind is, and this, by the way, this characteristic of the mind, its ability to experience and know things, is called, in some Buddhist texts, it's called luminosity. It's sometimes called clarity. It's got lots of names. But what it doesn't literally mean, click, click, a light, you know, that like there's a light on in an empty room. It's not exactly like that. So while we then say that the mind is limitless, it's also luminous. The mind is not established as a thing. It's not made of matter. It's not made of atoms or molecules. Mind is not a thing, and yet it is not nothing, because it knows, it experiences. But we misperceive this. We misperceive this. According to the teachings of Trungpa Rinpoche in the introduction, in his book, Creation and Completion, he says that we misperceive mind's emptiness or limitlessness. We misperceive it as a self. Like, there can't be nothing there. There's got to be somebody at home. It can't just be limitless. That's a little too big. Limitlessness is a little too big. So there's got to be somebody thinking this stuff. So we misperceive the limitless quality of the mind as a self. And we misperceive the luminosity aspect as a real external world of phenomena. That's how he explains it. So we make the mistake. I gave the example yesterday, the simplified example of the parakeet in the mirror. The bird looks at the glass and it doesn't know what's going on. It thinks there's another bird behind the glass. And so it'll either cuddle that reflection, it will attack that reflection, or it'll be indifferent to that reflection. But it misperceives the reflection as being another bird behind the glass. This is what happens to us. We have a thought and we think, wow, something's happened. Call the media. And we misperceive that thought as being different from the mind that just had it. We think of it as being separate from the mind, once it's out there and floating around. And that misperception then feeds on itself and keeps rolling and rolling and rolling and rolling and rolling. And so by the time somebody tells us for the first time, by the way, you have Buddha nature, we're like, no. Nah. Other people might have it, but not me. Mm-mm. No, I don't see that when I look in the mirror. Mm. But this idea of Buddha nature is the beginning, let's call it the crowbar, that is going to lever us out of confusion. This knowledge that there is this Buddha nature is what begins the path of awakening for many people. Kempo Karja Rinpoche, as I quoted yesterday, said that a lot of people come to the teachings of the Buddha with a little bit of skepticism. But he said after they actually sit and meditate and let their attention rest on the breath and maintain that attention for a short time, he said they will have an experience of their mind that's different. And that will give them confidence in the teachings of the Buddha. And so that's why I think meditation is such a valuable method toward awakening, because for many of us, it's the first time that we've been able to see our mind as something other than a little secretary that keeps us on track and propels us through a very busy life. So so the reason I brought that up was because of the seeming contradiction between Buddha nature and confusion. Well, that's how confusion begins. We experience our mind and instantly think that it is different from us. And so this is the beginning of self-fixation, the beginning of confusion and delusion. And the illustration, which I think we can hand out the illustration now, is a pictorial representation of how confusion manifests in our lives. So while that's being handed out, does anybody have questions, or anybody else need a drawing? Oh, you have a question? Okay, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yes, yes. Okay, thanks. Yes, you have a question? Yeah. Right. Right. And the person is asking, is the discrete mind a separate self? And how do those two concepts work together or against each other or whatever? This is, I think the way the words help me. And so we definitely have a mind, and it is discrete and separate from others.
And we have a self-concept. But the self-concept we have is not what we really are. So there is no self from it, there's no self from that point of view. There's no permanent, real, solid, unchanging self. Right. Yeah, that there's a self that is somehow separate from, yes, the mind that creates it. Yeah, and it's we use the concept of self as a convenience. I remember reading one article by a Buddhist teacher once who said, it's not that we're trying to get rid of self. We need it in order to interact. We need this concept of self to interact with others. The problem comes when we say myself over everything. It's kind of like, you know, we're sort of patriotic toward our myself, do or die, you know, and we defend it like that. Yeah. Our culture and all cultures really in the past have sort of glorified. And you know, and that's why we have so many monuments. Yes, uh-huh. Yes, I would say that the concept of self is a relative view of mind because it's a way of explaining one's experience. I'd go for that. Yeah.
All these years, I've kind of just put the sort of swallowed that whole thing about self under some kind of carpet. But to be really honest, I sometimes really think I am different than you.
Right.
I'm different than Marilyn.
Right. I don't think, I think that there is difference, there is a difference between you and other people. Uh-huh. And I'm sorry if what I say seems to say the opposite.
No, I'd like to be
okay, there. Okay. That's not what I meant to say, if that's what I said. So, yes, we are separate, but we all have a mind. We have different, let's put it this way, we have different karmic accumulation, for one thing. Mm-hmm. And that brings about the different characteristics that we have in our body, and we'll get to that, you know, shortly. And so, yes, we are different, but we all have a mind that has the same potential and the same potentiality to become Buddha if we apply the techniques and methods of awakening to ourselves. So I don't think there's a misperception so much. Okay, I'll do my best to define the mind because after all this time, I'm still trying to learn the terms and understand them. So basically what I end up doing a lot is repeating what the great teachers have said because that's the easiest way to express. Mind is that continuity. I think that's one of the Buddhist teachers called it a stream of being that moves from life to life and carries the karma of previous lifetimes. And but it also has the potential to know. It's not just a storehouse. It's not just a storehouse. It actually has the ability to know and be aware of and know itself. And when through the practice of calm abiding or shamatha meditation, it calms down the chatter in its flow, that sometimes it will be able to actually turn its attention to itself and experience itself as it really is, and that's called vipassana, or insight. And so having that insight is the beginning of the path to liberation from samsara, because once we know how our mind constructs samsaric clinging, then we can undo that. We can begin to undo that process. we can begin to interfere with the process of clinging and fixation and undo it so that we return to mind experiencing itself. Because the Buddha used the term, used the example or the parable of the ocean to describe the mind. He said the mind is like an ocean, and the thoughts and the feelings and the emotions are like the waves on that ocean. And when the waves come out of the ocean, we think for a moment that they're separate from the sea, but then they fall back into the sea and we realize they've never been separate from the sea, never. And this is part of the process of getting to know one's mind through the practice of meditation. Like the waves in the ocean, thoughts arise in our mind, and if we don't pursue them, they merely fall back into the mind and disappear, giving us an insight into how mind really is. And so I can't necessarily define mind because I'm not skilled enough with the words, but Trungpa Rinpoche himself likes to talk about mind as being a single thing with eight functions. And he calls these the eight consciousnesses. And this is the five of them are attached to our sense perceptions: taste, touch, hearing, smell, and sight. So there's a part of the mind that perceives and processes the information from the body of the five senses. There's a sixth consciousness that processes thoughts and impressions and perceptions. There's a seventh seventh consciousness that is called the emotional consciousness or the kleshic consciousness, because klesha means like mental affliction. And it's the part of us that it's that sense of self that is so deeply ingrained that it doesn't bubble up into our conscious thought. It's the part of us, it's that subtle sense of self that makes us jump when we hear a loud sound. And it is they call it the kleshic or the emotional consciousness because it gives birth to emotionality based on self-clinging. You know, based on this subtle sense of self-definition. And then the eighth consciousness underlies them all and is sometimes called for that reason the foundational or basis consciousness. And it's what stores our karma in its unenlightened state. And then when we become enlightened, it manifests as the all-basis wisdom. So you can talk about mind from this idea of this sort of more amorphous idea of mind being that which has always existed in us and always will exist and has these characteristics of emptiness and lucidity that we misperceive as a self and phenomena. But you can also think of it in, you can also explain mind in terms of these eight consciousnesses. Different people will respond to different explanations. And so anyway, sorry to go so deep on that, but it happens. Yeah. There's time for one more. Is there one more out there about all the stuff we've talked about? Yes, uh-huh. That's all right, but my answer will not be brief. Therefore, there are a few things you can count on in this world, and that's it. Okay. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. What's really interesting is that a lot of modern psychology books do talk about having a healthy sense of self, and how and here's my one Buddhist's impression. I'm not speaking for all Buddhists here. I'm just speaking for me.
Here's my impression about it. There's a healthy sense of self and an unhealthy inside relative truth. Okay, let's just stay with relative truth here. Ultimate truth, there's no self that we can. Okay, so it's like that's beyond all that. But from the relative point of view, where we have this concept of self and cling to it, there are two ways we can cling to this sense of self. Actually, there's probably 1,000, but two main ones: positively and negatively. It's still clinging, but it's positive clinging or negative clinging. The too far extreme on the positive side is, I'm so great, I am better than anybody. Okay? The clinging on the negative end is, I am the worst. I am absolutely the worst. Both of these interfere. Both of these concepts, these extreme concepts, interfere with our ability to practice meditation. The people who are extreme at one end, they're thinking, I don't need meditation, I'm perfect the way I am, you know. And the other people are saying, I'm so unworthy, I'm so bad, I could never meditate. So I feel as though Western psychology is doing us all a favor by describing these types of self-fixation and helping us intellectually walk them back to the center. People who have too great of an opinion of themselves need to kind of even that out a little bit and get a little more humble. People who are at the other end of the spectrum, who don't think as much of themselves, need to actually come up again toward the middle and have a better sense of themselves. So I think that within relative truth, we do have to have a healthy sense of self, and therefore we must apply whatever relative truth methods we need to bring ourselves up. We need, because if we don't bring ourselves up toward the middle, we won't really be able to grasp the Dharma or practice it to the extent we want to. Because we want to practice, but we have these habits of thinking that get in our way. And so it's really important to follow that advice to have a healthy sense of self. Because as Pema Chodron once said, you know, sometimes you have to bring a person from an unhealthy sense of self to a healthy sense of self before you can go beyond self. You know? You've got to have that healthy, you know what I'm saying? You have to have that, you have to get healthy. And so taking good care of yourself in that way is actually kind of good Dharma, too, if you think about it. It's kind of good Dharma because do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. In that second one, it's like you take care of yourself and benefit others. And so, does that make... Yeah. Confidence is good. Yeah, confidence is good. And I like the word confidence because there's like two kinds. There's confidence in the Dharma, and then there's also confidence in your ability to practice it. It's like if you got both, you're going someplace. If you got one, okay, just keep working and getting toward the other. Does that make sense? Okay, yeah. Yes. I said that was the last question, but, you know, hey, I can't stop. Yes, go ahead. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
So if what I'm hearing right,
yeah,
meditation should help.
Yeah.
In all of our lives to try mm-hmm. to balance that to some degree. So
it isn't. Yeah. The questioner is saying, isn't a meditation really the? I'm going to use a different word. Secret sauce. Isn't meditation? Isn't meditation? I know. I got plenty of sleep last night too. I'm just wacky today. Is meditation the method that helps us even things out? And the answer is yes. Because you're absolutely right. People can become so enamored of affirmations and things like that, that they'll go too far. They'll go past the center, the middle of, you know, of good self-health. If you can say that, is that a word? Anyway, good. They'll go halfway. They'll go past the healthy middle of self-health. being a writer is such a difficult thing. Life. Anyway, self-health. Okay, cool. Okay, so they'll go past. They'll go. You know, I'm having a great. I love you guys. This is just great. So you'll go past the middle into some kind of like not irrational, but unreasonable self-fixation. I'm great. Yeah, you know what's really funny? Human beings also seem to have a hard time at balancing things. I don't know about you, but I have a friend who told me once, he said, how will I know if I've gone to an extreme until I've already gone to that extreme? How will I know that I've gone to an extreme? I mean, you know. Get feedback. That's absolutely right. And that's exactly what we do, is we get feedback is from ourselves and from our environment and other people. It's like, oh, you're getting a little too far in this direction. You know, so, So, yeah, balance is what we have to work on. And meditation, it promotes balance in that you become more aware of your thoughts when you are a meditator. Because watching your breath as the object of meditation, a thought will come up, but then you'll note its presence and then return your attention to the breath. Well, that thought disappears once you stop paying attention to it. And what this process does, is it makes us aware of our moment-to-moment thinking when we are not meditating. And this helps us to make changes in our behavior, because we can begin to see our anger rising in us, for example, before things come out of our mouth, which is really helpful. And so for me, it was like, I could see them coming, but they came out anyway. But I think that that's how balance happens, gradually over time, as we take, as Kempo Carthur Rinpoche, one of his books was titled, Embracing What is Genuine and Discarding That Which is Not Worthwhile. And I think that that's really the whole of the path for us as beginners, is embracing that which is genuine dharma and discarding that which is not worthwhile. So we have to just keep doing that. Okay. To the drawing. Okay. Okay, quiz. Pop quiz. Who can tell me what's in the center of the drawing? Okay, Justin?
The pig
represents ignorance. The snake biting the tail. Okay. Right. It's a circular arrangement of symbolic animals. The pig symbolizes ignorance, which begins with the ignorance of our own true nature. It's the ignorance of our Buddha nature. When we don't know about our Buddha nature, we then believe in the reality of everything. And therefore, we develop aversion for things we don't like, which is symbolized by the snake. And then we develop attachment for things we do like, which is symbolized by the rooster. And the fact that they're depicted, these animals, these symbolic animals are depicted in a circle biting their tails, biting each other's tails, indicates that ignorance gives birth to these other two and keeps them rolling. And I was joking yesterday that this is like an engine of samsara, because this wheel, can someone tell me who the being holding the wheel is? Who's holding the wheel? Yama, right. Yama is called, symbolically called the Lord of Death. The word death in Buddhist teachings, is symbolic of all the sufferings of samsara. It's like death is shorthand. You know, death and all of that. Death and all the rest. That's samsara. Around the center of the wheel, those three symbolic animals, which are, oh, by the way, they're symbolic, they're called the three poisons, the three mental poisons. ignorance, attachment, and aversion or anger. Now, on the next circle outside that, there are two images, one on the right and one on the left. Can someone tell me what the one on the left is? The image, the semicircular image. What's that? That is on the left. Okay. I had it backwards in my mind. Yes, it starts with a person offering a lamp, and it concludes with someone experiencing a higher, a pleasant rebirth. And so what's on the other side? What's on the other side of the semicircle? Right. A person entering bondage and being dragged into the lower realms of existence. And so these two semicircles on either side of the central figure of the three animals, that semicircle depicts the two choices we have in this life. We can perform unselfish, virtuous action and rise higher in a rebirth, or we can take on and practice self-centered negative actions and become bound to the samsaric world and into the depths of lower rebirth. So in a way, this is, you could say this is a cautionary tale. Tell me, who is depicted at the upper right hand of the picture? The Buddha. And he is pointing to something. What is he pointing to? The moon. And what is the moon symbolic of? Enlightenment. The moon is symbolic of enlightenment. And can anybody tell me what's in the Tibetan legend that's written below the moon? Basically, that's right. It's the four statements: do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. That's what's written in the Tibetan legend there. And so, so the Buddha is saying, is pointing the way to awakening. Why is the Buddha outside the wheel? He's outside samsara. He's no longer trapped in samsara. And he is showing the way to liberation from samsara. Samsara is depicted as a wheel here. Does anybody know why it's depicted as a circular wheel? Yes. Samsara does mean cycle, like cyclic existence. There is also the sense of beings cycling through different experiences in samsara. And so, yes, and so it has the appearance of being beginningless and endless, which, by the way, is symbolically interesting. Let's just go back thematically, philosophically for just a second. What else is limitless? Mind. Just thought I'd draw that distinction. Okay, back to the explanation. I'm just saying, isn't that interesting? Samsara has the appearance in relative truth of being beginningless and endless. And yet the mind also is beginningless. I'm here to, you know, okay. So let's see. There are five divisions in this wheel. What do they represent? They show the six realms of existence. One of the sections in the drawing has two realms included in it, and I'll get to that in a second. But what interests me about this is that these six realms of existence are said to be the experiences we have when we pursue specific mental afflictions. You can describe mental afflictions as being three, as being five, or as being six, or as being 84,000. There are 84,000 is just a big number. It really means they're limitless. The three poisons in the drawing are ignorance, aversion and attachment. But they can be expanded, the list can be expanded to include stinginess or miserliness, and to include pride and jealousy. So those can be added to it to form six. When five are mentioned, stinginess is left out. So if there are three, it's ignorance, aversion, and attachment. If it is five, pride and jealousy are added. And if it is six, stinginess and miserliness is added. And the reason that these six types of experience are enumerated on the wheel is that there are two ways to look at it. One way to look at it is that these are the mental states that we personally can cycle through in any given day. We can be angry, we can be prideful, we can be jealous, we can be attached to things or obsessed with things, we can be stingy, we can be bewildered or ignorant, we can be angry, we can be all of these things. We can experience through all of these. The Buddha's teaching on karma is that when we consciously engage, when we consciously and purposefully and intentionally engage in certain mental states, like anger or attachment, we experience a resulting experience from that. It's called the law of karma, also called action, cause, and result. Action, cause, and result. When we do, think, or say anything with intention, it imprints on our relative all-base consciousness. It imprints on our storehouse consciousness, our foundational consciousness. And then that implanted seed of karma influences how we experience things going forward. It influences our experience. You could say it conditions our experience of everything. And it comes to fruition as specific experiences. The fruition shown here is pictorial in nature. But it's safe to say that the lowest of these experiences is at the bottom of the drawing. This is the hell experience that we have when we are consumed with anger. The hell experience when we are consumed with anger. The image at the drawings right, just above that, is the realm of the deprived spirits. And this is the outcome of miserliness and stinginess. When we are not generous, we experience the feeling that we never have enough of anything. On the opposite side, on our left, is the realm of animals. Animal experience arises from chosen ignorance, choosing to remain bewildered. It's symbolized by the choiceless instinct of the animals who hunt, kill, and eat one another. We are not talking about the experience of beloved pets in America. At the upper quadrant, on our right, is the human realm, where people, through obsessive attachment to comfort, toil endlessly to obtain comfort and security. And in the upper left-hand quadrant, that was the upper right-hand quadrant. The upper left-hand quadrant of the picture depicts two realms, the realm of the asuras, or the jealous gods, on the lower left of that drawing,
And then in the upper of that drawing is the realm of the gods, those who live out a prideful existence. So these are symbolic pictorial depictions of the fruition of these negative mental afflictions. And as I said, we can go through any one of these in a given day, sometimes all of them, sometimes in a half an hour. We can be at our workplace and see somebody who was promoted instead of us and feel jealousy. We can see a new hire and feel pride and superiority. We can choose to numb ourselves out with the internet on a break. We can toil obsessively to get comfort. We can feel stinginess when someone asks us for something and we hesitate to give. And then finally, if we get angry with someone, it's as though we're consumed with this fire of hatred. So all of these experiences are things we can cycle through in a single day. And what the Buddha is trying to point out by pointing toward that legend in the corner is he's saying, okay, I know this is how you feel, but do no harm. Practice virtue and tame your mind. That this is the path toward awakening. So what he's saying is, if you become aware of these thoughts and discard these negative things, then you will be able to be more free of these kinds of suffering. You will be more free of these kinds of suffering in a relative sense. And in the ultimate sense, you will slowly and gradually work toward liberation, total liberation from samsara suffering. So that's a brief review. This will be the second time we've been through this part of the drawing. Any questions about this part? Yes. You know, sometimes I think that chosen ignorance arises in lots of different ways in our human life, because the result is the birth of the animal. The result of chosen ignorance is the birth as an animal. Trungpa Rinpoche talked about something he called animal samadhi, and I wonder about this sometimes, the idea that you can get sort of lost in something, a hobby or a repetitive task, and you're just kind of like checked out, you know. And so there's, it's not a samadhi or a meditative, the word samadhi means meditative absorption. It's not a truly meditative absorption, because a meditative absorption deals with the mind and its experience. Whereas the animal samadhi is kind of like numbing yourself out with something. I sometimes wonder, I don't know if this qualifies as chosen bewilderment, but it could be that it could be similar to people hearing about Buddha nature and saying, ah, bah, that's just humbug, that's impossible, it's ridiculous. Or it could be like someone who sees the truth but chooses not to act on it. And those are all kinds of chosen bewilderment. I think that if I remember correctly, there are other types, you know, where people just choose to be numb rather than to know the truth. That results in an animal rebirth.
So the animal itself chooses.
Correct. Although I'll tell you what, the animals driven by instinct have a hard time getting out. They have a hard time. So that's why we have to love them and be kind to them. Yeah. Because they're really stuck right now. Until the karma that created that has been worn off, or has fully come to fruition. So for some animals, it's
when we meet them the first time. That's their last animal birth, and we don't know it, you know. Yes.
I was going to say, I wouldn't mind being a dog in Bhutan.
Are they beloved?
Yes. They live 16 dogs life.
Oh. Yeah, I have a feeling, though, you know, the problem is that once you're reborn as an animal, it's kind of hard to get out. So I don't recommend it. I think what I would do if you had that kind of interest would be to gain rebirth in one of the pure realms, like Amitabha's pure realm, and then go and emanate as an animal to help somebody. I'd do that instead. That way you know. You wouldn't have the danger of falling into even lower states. See, that's a problem with samsara. No matter where you are, you know, even if you're in the highest realm, we had this discussion yesterday, even if you're in the God realm, you're still in samsara. And being in the God realm really uses up your good karma. So then when the God is about to die in that existence, they look down and go, oh no. Because there's no place else to go but down. And I think about the human realm and all of the fabulously resourced individuals in this world who may not be using their resources wisely, and at some point they're going to look and go, oh no. And that's hard. That's really hard. Anything else to talk about this? Yes. I'm glad you asked that question, because I did forget to mention that. And that is that, yes, the human realm is said to be the best place to be reborn, because we don't have the unrelenting suffering of the lowest realms or the unrelenting comfort of the higher realms. We have a mixture of happiness and suffering, so we can tell the difference and know which we want to pick. And then also because we have the intellectual capacity and the opportunity to practice the Dharma and gain liberation. So it is said that the human realm is the best place in samsara. If you're going to be reborn in samsara, that's the best place to be. And that's why a lot of Buddhist aspiration prayers near the end, you'll almost always see this near the end. May I be reborn in a good family with intelligence, without arrogance, and in the presence of Dharma. And because sometimes people are born with intelligence, but then they develop arrogance, and they don't even think about the Dharma. So it's almost like we're setting the coordinates for a good human rebirth there, and that type of aspiration. Other things that people might comment? Yes.
Can you share the last days of God realm person?
Hmm. Yeah, they say that the last 7 days of a God realm person is a kind of, it's really tough. They talk about it symbolically and from the point of view of legend, but you get the idea. They wear flower garlands, and they begin to brown and fade, and the other gods say, uh-oh, they're on the way out. And then the gods, the bodies of the gods begin to give off an odor. They had always smelled wonderful before. And now they begin to have this negative smell. And then the other gods go, they're on their way out. And they withdraw from their fellow god. And then because the gods have great insight, they look and they see that their lives are coming to an end, and they actually can see the place of their lower rebirth, and it makes them terrified, nauseous, and really sick just to see what's going to happen, because they had not paid any attention before, and now suddenly there it is. Their ruin, their ruin is shown to them, and the inevitability of their ruin is shown to them. And it is said that the last 7 days of the life of a god are the intense suffering. But even if we look at, even if these sort of symbolic descriptions don't touch us, we look at the lives of the rich and famous in a human world, and we see how they can suffer intense reversals of fortune. They can lose their money instantly. They can lose their good looks instantly. They can lose their fame and then become infamous or notorious instantly and be a pariah among humans. It can happen just like that. And so that's what I know of it. Do you have other things?
No, okay. I always like that symbolism. I think that applies also to humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not just something that happens. And, you know, you look at how people who are sick in all kinds of ways, how they're treated here and everywhere. It's not pretty how people who are sick, whether they're sick with a mental condition, physical condition, both, how people who are dying are isolated and we withdraw. Right. And we don't want to get close to that because we don't want to know. Yeah, so it's like that. Yeah, oh, boy, lots to talk about. Yes? Have any gods reached enlightenment? You know, I would have to ask one of the scholars that question. You've got to imagine that it has to have happened, but I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you. I mean, you know, the Buddha's mother was reborn in the realm of the 33. And I don't know whether his, because the Buddha went there to give teachings, and I don't know whether his teachings there resulted in anybody gaining awakening or not. I'd have to have a deeper study of the life, story of the Buddha and so forth to know more about that. Other? Yes? Right.
You have to have the ability to get some sort of karma, or if there will never be maturity of who you are, and there will be that. So it's sort of like, sometimes I think that it's a raw, human, you can only be there to get enlightened.
Yeah.
But I honestly can imagine that there will be enlightened beings, and maybe I've heard this from some of Buddha's stories, that like there's even never been that.
Right.
And like the tiger and all of that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we don't really have any way of knowing that that's not true. I mean, I still, because I'm ignorant or whatever, believe that if you wanted to be some kind of an animal, and you were born some kind of an animal, you could still live in that kind of lifestyle, a pure, dharmic kind of style. And there has to be something available to you to make positive karma. So, I don't know. But
yeah. I mean, you know, and I appreciate you, you're sharing your thoughts about this because, yeah, I know a lot of people do like animal, the idea of being reborn as an animal. They really like the idea. They think it's great. And then they'll come up with all kinds of reasons as to why it's good to be reborn as an animal. But over and over again, the lamas just say, don't risk it. Because they say that there's too much risk. Because you don't know what your other karma is. This is the problem. You don't know what your other karma is. And your other karma may actually drive you down deeper and prevent you from having a good life as an animal. And so because you don't know what your karma is, you got to go for the sure thing, which is to be reborn as a human. I know it sounds to you, I know it's... Right. That's true. You have the ability. Yeah, but the problem is that, yes, you can accumulate a lot of negative karma as a human being. However, it still is the best place where you actually have less risk. You have less risk as a human than as an animal, because you have the potential to practice Dharma as a human, where you don't have the practice of Dharma as an animal. You just don't even have the chance. In fact, Jamgon Kontrol, in his book, The Torch of Certainty, says an animal cannot even recite one mantra, and yet they can accumulate tons of negative karma that will drive them even deeper. And so this is why it's generally said that even though we may have a sort of romantic idea about animals, and a romantic idea that, oh, I would love to be an animal and be free as a bird and fly and all of this, and we might create reasons in our mind as to why it would be great to be born as an animal. The Buddha, arguably one of the smartest people who ever lived, said it's a bad risk. So if you want to disregard that, that's fine. But I think that he's pointing to the moon of awakening for a reason, and not to disappoint you. I mean, you know. Yeah, that is, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So your complaint about the teachings, your complaint about the Buddha's teaching is that it's human-centric. Your complaint is that it's human-centric. And you think that if the Buddha was a better teacher, he would agree. He would agree, and it wouldn't be so, he would not discriminate against animals. Yeah.
Oh,
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is, if the Buddha was smarter, he would know. If the Buddha were smarter, he would know that there is a future time when animals and humans can speak. Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. I know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 No, I understand. Yeah, I understand. No, I understand. Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah. Yeah. No, I understand. Mm-hmm. Right. And I do understand, and I appreciate your patience. I appreciate your patience with my poking on this, because my job, as I see it, and it may not be my job, but it's the way I see my job, is to say that the Buddha presented this to you personally for a reason. He presented this to you personally for a reason, and that is to save you from lower realms. And it's fine to disagree with it, but I would, if it was me, I would strongly recommend praying to be reborn in a pure realm, such as Amitabha's pure realm, and then from there emanate to the other realms and benefit the beings there, rather than take the risk, which we don't know. Because you don't know whether there's a rhapsodic romantic future where the animals and people can talk, you know.
Yeah.
Cool.
Because from
then my job is done. Yeah.
So that is my plan.
Okay.
But it's also true that there's a lot of prideful humanity about there not being animals. And there's a lot of going down, and I think that it provides a lot of people who are animals.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To get to that final.
Yeah, no, I understand. That's true.
All the design that we've done, but so far it sounds like it's been pretty personal, you know, up here, up here, up there. Mm-hmm. As an individual. But, you know, mm-hmm. it's neckier than that. But
Yeah, you know, and I really appreciate your clarifying your position, because I was poking because I was trying to figure out your position, and I really appreciate your being completely clear about your position, that human centrism really engenders a kind of pride in humans that makes it easy for humans to abuse, kill, hurt animals. And each other, of course. But I really appreciate you clarifying that for me, because that makes it a lot more clear for me as to why you feel the way you do. But and I also really appreciate you letting me know that your plan is Dewa Chan.
Okay.
Because, you know, because then my job is done. Yeah, you know, because and then when you get to Dewa Chen, you can ask Amitabha all of these questions, and you will have no qualms with his answers. I mean, you know, because all will become clear once you get there. And then you can take on the special mission of benefiting all of those beings that are suffering so much in like the animal realm and elsewhere. So that's a super cool thing. Yeah, we have about 7 minutes to go before the top of the hour. I will take the last two questions, but then I will hold everybody after school for about 5 minutes so we can meditate. Does that sound okay? I will have to stop with these two questions, 1 and 2.
It sounds like we continuously are in this circle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is the questioner is asking, because samsara is circular, is described as being circular, is there a way to get out of samsara? And I would say the answer to that is absolutely yes, because the Buddha standing outside samsara is pointing to those four statements: do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind, or know your mind. And I think that if we can do those three things, do no harm, practice virtue, and then also tame and also understand our mind, then that will bring the liberation from samsara. That will do it. That's the how. And then once we're liberated from that, then we can, if we've taken the bodhisattva vow, which is part of our conversation here earlier, if we've taken the bodhisattva vow, then we will go to all the realms and benefit beings there. Yeah. We will absolutely go there and absolutely benefit them everywhere. So,
what are your explanations for what it means to something?
Yeah. Well, you know, you're right. There's two ways to look at it. It's been Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, when he was actually talking about rebirth in lower realms, he said it's a bad move because you can't know all of your karma. You just can't. There's just so much of it. There's no way you know it all. But it's very interesting because Guru Rinpoche, who lived in India and Tibet, you know, 1,000 years ago, he said if you want to know who you were in a previous life or what you did in a previous life, look at your present situation. And if you want to know who you will be in a future lifetime, look at your present actions. And so you could say that a deep analysis of your current situation could give you some insight. It may not give you chapter and verse on all of your karma, but it could give you some insight. For example, if you are financially comfortable, it means that you benefited others and took care of them in previous lifetimes. If you have relative good health, that means that you had very good ethical behavior. And if you have a form that other people find pleasing, then that means that you had good moral conduct. So there are all of these kinds of clues that are given in the teachings, because since we know the results of actions, because they've been described by the Buddha, we can look at our lives and say, well, did we have this or did we have that? And that'll give you a clue. But there's also trying to figure out what will be in the future. And I think what we think about now and believe in now and do now does influence what we will be and do in the future. So we have to, that's why he's saying, do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind, because this is how you will adjust your karma for the future. Lately, I've thought of a weird concept. You know, we were talking about concepts a minute ago. I have a really weird concept. And my really weird concept is that I've begun thinking about my future life as though I were thinking about a child of mine. I never had children, so I don't know what that's like. But I see what people do for their kids. They sacrifice everything for their kids. And they do everything they can to give that child a good education, a good life, a good moral compass, everything. And I think, well, golly, why can't I do that for the child I'll become in the future? Why can't I do more good actions now so that I can provide for who I will be in the future? I don't know that kid, but that kid's going to be me. And why don't I do good actions now? So anyhow, I guess I just have this weird idea, but it's something that's been floating around. Providing for the person I will be in the future so that they have a good life. We do all this for our kids. Why don't we do it for ourselves? I'm just saying. It's kind of interesting. Anyway, I have weird thoughts. Okay. So anyway, thank you. And I apologize if that was unfair. But I'm just trying to get to the... Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, excellent. Yeah. So I appreciate all of you for bringing your sincerity and your wish to learn about Dharma to this place. I always love what Dharma people do to a space. There was a art class in here yesterday, and we've done a Nyungne in this room. We did a 2.5-day Nyungne retreat in this room. I think it feels pretty good in here. Anyway, so we can make it better by spending the next few minutes doing some meditation. If you remember when we shared the technique for meditation previously, it was to place the body in the posture of meditation. If you're sitting in a chair, your feet are flat on the floor. Your hands are palm downward on the legs. If you're sitting on the floor, you can cross your legs in one of many different ways. And place your hands, again, palm downward on the legs. The shoulders can be straight, the chin tucked in slightly. The gaze can be cast downward, gazing, not looking, gazing. Lastly, the tip of the tongue can be touched to the upper palate behind the front teeth as a way of relaxing the muscles in the face. You begin with a mental attitude, I will meditate on, I will become aware of my breath and remain aware of my breath for the next little while as a method of meditation to benefit all beings. Begin with one deep breath, breathe out, and then allow the breath to come and go naturally, following the course of the breath with your attention. If thoughts arise, you can note them and return to the breath for a fresh start. Thank you. Two things. This afternoon, we'll start the afternoon session at 2:30, and we'll start with a discussion of how sitting meditation enables us to embrace that which is genuine and discard that which is not worthwhile. And then after a short discussion of that, we'll move on to discussing the outermost ring of the drawing, the 12 nidanas, or the 12 links of interdependent origination. And what this is these are the 12 steps of that go into creating karma and experiencing its fruition. So we're going to talk about that this afternoon, and then complete our conversation about the path of liberation by talking about how the practices of Dharma liberate us, how shamatha meditation, compassion meditation, and mantra meditation liberate us from samsara. So that's this afternoon. We'll go from 2:30 to 4. There's one thing I wanted to mention. There are several versions of this drawing, as I mentioned, and in some of them, I don't think it's in this one. No. But there are different versions of the drawing that actually have little Buddhas in them. They're little Buddhas. And each of these little Buddhas have names. I don't have that. I didn't bring that book with me today. It's in a book that's out of print called Showing the Path to Liberation. I'm sorry, wrong book. It's the book about Genrezi. It'll come to me. Oh, well. It's not Lord of Love. It's the one that Ponlop Rinpoche published. Anyway, it's that one. It has the 15th Karmapa's commentary on Genrezi in it. And they have the names in there, the names of each of the Buddhas. In each of the realms. And the reason I wanted to bring this up was because of the previous statement made about everybody having Buddha nature, even if they are in the lower realms, and that's actually true. Kempo Rinpoche said that I've forgotten all their names. He said, but I've seen the pictures in which they're in these six realms. There's a Buddha in each realm. And he says, I've forgotten about the symbolism of that. He said, but I think it's a way of saying that all beings have Buddha nature, no matter where they are. And so they can experience liberation. And in fact, there are stories told about teachers going into the lower realms to interrupt the karma. Rinpoche spoke about that this weekend. To interrupt the karma, momentarily interrupt the karma of their disciples who have been born in lower realms. So there's all kinds of interesting possibilities out there that the teachings allow for. So anyway, just thought I'd mention that. So let's dedicate the merit of our session today. We dedicate the merit to all suffering beings in all the realms. May we have compassion for them all. May we work to liberate them and ourselves from samsara. And becoming Buddhas, may we emanate in all of the realms and lift up anyone we possibly can and bring them to awakening. We'll mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind.
Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you. See you this afternoon.